Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 2 Kings chapter 13. We're going to do the whole chapter today, verses 1 through 25. We will take a look at the reigns of Jehoahaz and Jehoash, his son, two kings of Israel, and we're going to watch Elisha die. Our context is this. In the last chapter, chapter 12 of 2 Kings, we saw the southern king, Joash, repair the temple, and then he ended his miserable life after he murdered the son, Zechariah, of Jehoiada the prophet. So we start now in 2 Kings 13, 1 through 3. In the 23rd year of Joash, the son of Ahaziah, Joash ruled from 835 to 796. He was the son of Ahaziah, who, of course, ruled and died in 841 B.C. That's the southern Ahaziah, and Joash is the southern king Joash. These chroniclers of the kings of Judah and Israel like to take notice of how the kings in the other part of Israel were doing, the northern kings and the southern kings, so they relate their reigns in terms of each other. So in the 23rd year of Joash, Joash ruled in 835. If you take 23 away from that, you get 812, and Jehoahaz starts ruling then, except he rules in 814, because you have to account for parts of a year and for accession years and regencies and all that kind of stuff. So that's close enough. Jehoahaz, who we will be looking at in this chapter, he ruled from 814 to 798. He was the son of Jehu, the famous usurper of the northern kingdom, the scourge of the house of Ahab, the murderer, I shouldn't say murderer, the executioner of wicked Queen Jezebel. Jehu had ruled from 841 to 814. Jehoahaz takes over from 814 to 798. So we're going to look at Jehoahaz in this audio. So Jehoahaz becomes king over Israel at Samaria, and he reigned 17 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord and followed the sins of Jeroboam. That's Jeroboam the first, who ruled 931 to 910, the son of Nebat, with which he made Israel sin. He did not turn from them. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he, Yahweh, gave Israel continually into the hand of Hazael. That's the king of Syria, king of Aram. Hazael ruled from 841 to 801. And into the hand of Ben-Hadad, that's Ben-Hadad the third. He ruled from 807, there's a co-regency there with his father Hazael, and he ruled down to 780. So now Jehoahaz is said to continue the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Jeroboam the first, that of course is golden calf worship. That's what Jeroboam the first is noted for. He set up golden calves with which to worship Yahweh in the northern town of Dan and the southern town of Bethel. John Gill says, quote, Israel's apostasy from the true God became greater and more confirmed than in the time of his father Jehu. So things were bad with Jehu, except Jehu did wipe out all the Baal worshippers. He didn't wipe out the golden calf worship, and Jehoahaz didn't wipe it out either. As a result, in verse 3, the anger of the Lord is kindled against Israel, and he gave them continually into the Syrians, Hazael and Hazael's son Ben-Hadad III. Jameson Fawcett Brown says about that, quote, the national chastisement when it came was consequently the more severe, and the instruments employed by the Lord in scourging the revolted nation were Hazael and his son and general Ben-Hadad, in resisting whose successive invasions the Israelitish army was sadly reduced and weakened. Now, of course, the problem with God causing his chosen people to get whipped up on by pagans is that pagan enemies would then taunt the Israelites and taunt Yahweh and say, what kind of a God is Yahweh? He's forsaken Israel. That's always the problem. We see this in Deuteronomy 32:27, when Yahweh says this, Had I not feared the provocation by the enemy, lest their adversary should misjudge, lest they should say, our hand is triumphant and the Lord has not done all this. But God is sovereign. He knows how to work around that problem, chastising when he will, showing mercy when he will, keeping the covenant promise alive and the covenant people alive, but then chastising them for their sins by defeats. Now, this Ben-Hadad, as I said, is Ben-Hadad III. There's two other Ben-Hadads. According to Easton's here, Ben-Hadad I, he ruled from 885 to 860. He fought against Asa, invaded Israel. And then Ben-Hadad I's son, Ben-Hadad II, he ruled from 860 to 841. He long engaged in war against Israel, too. So you see, for roughly just under 100 years, Israel is fighting Aram, fighting Syria. Ben-Hadad II was murdered by Hazael. Hazael takes over. 841 to 801. And then in 807, there's a Regency there. Ben-Hadad III, Hazael's son, takes over. And I notice Ben-Hadad III is not a descendant of Ben-Hadad I and Ben-Hadad II. That family had been wiped out by Hazael. We go now to 2 Kings 13, 4 through 9. Then Jehoahaz, that's the northern king, Jehoahaz, who ruled from 814 to 798, the son of Jehu. He needs to be distinguished from one of the last kings of Israel, right? During the time of the Babylonian invasions in the early 6th century B.C., which is a long time from now, and it's in a different kingdom, the south. So we should be able to distinguish this northern Jehoahaz. Then Jehoahaz sought the Lord's favor, and the Lord heard him. For he saw the oppression the king of Aram inflicted on Israel. And of course, remember, Aram is Syria. Therefore, the Lord gave Israel a deliverer, and they escaped from the power of the Arameans. Then the people of Israel dwelt in their tents as before, but they didn't turn away from the sins that the house of Jeroboam had caused Israel to commit, the golden calf idolatry. Jehoahaz walked in them, and the Asherah pole also remained standing in Samaria. Jehoahaz did not have an army left except for 50 horsemen, 10 chariots, and 10,000 foot soldiers, because the king of Aram had destroyed them, making them like dust at threshing. That's Hazael, the king of Syria, wiped him out to where Jehoahaz had a little rump army left. Verse 8, the rest of the events of Jehoahaz's reign, along with all his accomplishments and his might, are written in the historical record of Israel's kings. Jehoahaz rested with his fathers, and he was buried in Samaria. His son Jehoash, who ruled from 798 to 782, his son Jehoash became king in his place. Now in verse 4, we see Jehoahaz seeking Yahweh, which is interesting because the northern kings are supposed to be idolaters by this point. You notice that Jehoahaz didn't go to the golden calves in his distress. He sought Yahweh. I'm assuming he didn't go to a Yahweh golden calf temple. As a result, in verse 4, the Lord, Yahweh, heard Jehoahaz. He saw the oppression that the king of Aram inflicted on Israel. That could have either been Hazael or Ben-Hadad III, because their two reigns, because Jehoahaz's reign in northern Israel overlapped those two kings of Syria. And so as a result of Jehoahaz praying to Yahweh, Yahweh gave Israel a deliverer. Now, who was this deliverer? Could have been an angel, could have been an unnamed military leader, could have been Jehoahaz himself. But I think it was probably Jehoahaz's son Jehoash, who ruled from 798 to 782. Why do we say that this is the deliverer was probably Jehoash? Gill and Clark think so. Well, we read in 2 Kings 13:25, later on in this chapter, then Jehoash, son of Jehoahaz, took back from Ben-Hadad, son of Hazael, the cities that Hazael had taken in war from Jehoash's father Jehoahaz. Jehoash defeated Ben-Hadad III three times and recovered the cities of Israel. So there's your deliverer. Most probably, it's Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz. Now, Jameson Fawcett and Brown says that it's Jehoahaz's son Jehoahash and Jehoash's successor Jeroboam II. 2 Kings 14:25, in our next chapter, we read that Jeroboam II, who ruled from 782 to 753, restored the border of Israel from the entrance of Hamath, that's way up there toward Lebanon, between the anti-Lebanon and Lebanon ranges, as far as the Sea of the Arba, that's all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba. I guess that's what the Sea of the Arba is, according to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, which he spoke through his servant Jonah. So Jeroboam II whipped up on the Syrians, as did Jehoash. At any rate, that's how we can remember Jehoahaz. He's the guy that had to be rescued from the Syrians by his descendants. He walked in the sins, the golden calf idolatry, the sins of Jeroboam, and he left an Asherah pole standing in Samaria. Samaria, of course, is the capital of northern Israel. The Asherah pole, of course, that's Asherah or Astarte, same thing, the famous Lebanese, or I should say Phoenician idol, goddess, that pole of Asherah, that image of Asherah that's mentioned in verse 6 is probably a wooden image of the goddess who had similar rites to the rites of Baal. Baal and Astarte went together. Baal is a male god and Astarte is the female god. Neither Jehu nor Jehoahaz, grandfather and son, grandfather and father of Jehoash, those two ancestors had not cut that pole down, neither did Jehoahaz. Now, Jehoahaz's father, Jehu, had destroyed the worship of Baal. He had made the temple of Baal into a latrine, but he left that pole up for some reason. That Asherah pole had been set up by Ahab of the dynasty, Omri's dynasty, previous to Jehu. Ahab was 974 to 952, if I remember correctly. So that was a good ways back. But that Asherah pole, had been there a while. 1 Kings 16:33, and Ahab also made the Asherah. Thus Ahab did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel than all the kings of Israel who were before him. So this Asherah pole was a running sore, and it was still there under Jehoahaz. And so Jehoahaz paid the price, got whipped up on by Hazael of Syria. The law had told the kings, had told the Israelites, they're supposed to destroy these Asherah poles. Deuteronomy 7:5, but thus you shall do to them. You shall tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and hew down their Asherim. Hew down means to chop them down because they were wooden poles, wooden images. Hew down their Asherim. Asherim is plural of Asherah. Burn their graven images with fire. Well, they weren't keeping the law, so they didn't do it. Now, verse 8 says you can read about the might of Jehoahaz in the historical record of Israel's kings. That's a chronicle or an annal of northern Israel. It's been lost. It's been used as a source by the author of Kings, who is probably Jeremiah. And if you look in that book, which is lost, you will find all of Jehoahaz's accomplishments and his might. Well, it's interesting that his might is mentioned here. He's gotten whipped up on by Hazael, or perhaps Ben-Hadad III, the Syrian kings. He's been whipped up on to such an extent they only had 50 horsemen left, 10 chariots, and 10,000 foot soldiers. So why would the historical record of Israel's kings, or why would the book of Kings, the canonical book of Kings, 2 Kings here, why would it speak of Jehoahaz's might? Jameson Foster and Brown comments on this, quote, "This is particularly noticed in order to show that the grievous oppression from foreign enemies by which the Israelites were ground down was not owing to the cowardice or imbecility of their king, but solely to the righteous and terrible judgment of God for their foul apostasy." Well, I think that's true, but I don't think it explains the might comment. Kyle and Delitz say this, "Jehoahaz had probably shown his might in the war with the Syrians, although he had been overcome." Well, that's having it both ways. You fight mightily, and then you get your rear end whooped. I don't know. Maybe it's just exaggeration. Maybe it's just talking about Jehoahaz's might before he got beaten by the Syrians. At any rate, verse 9, Jehoahaz rested. He was buried in Samaria. And his son, Jehoash, in 798, takes over. So Jehoash is going to rule from 798 to 782. The father, Jehoahaz, having ruled from 814 to 798. He's gone. Now, there's not much to remember about Jehoahaz, except he got beat by the Syrians. But his son, Jehoash, is kind of an interesting guy. And we're going to call him Jehoash, not Joash, but Jehoash. Because remember, there's a southern king named Joash, who ruled from 835 to 796. He was the guy that rebuilt the temple and then killed Zechariah, the son of the high priest Jehoiada. Got assassinated, actually. Died a miserable death. But that's the southern king, Joash. We're now talking about the northern king, Jehoash. And I emphasize that because some translations, like the New American Standard Bible, translates Joash as Jehoash sometimes. It just makes a very difficult situation even more confusing. So I use the Holman Christian Study Bible, which, thank God for them, they distinguish Jehoash and Joash and other kings they distinguish too. They give them different names, if at all possible. So we're going to look at Jehoash. As I said, he ruled from 798 to 782. He was the son of the Jehoahaz, who just got whipped up by the Syrians and only had 50 horsemen left. And Jehoash became king over Israel and Samaria and reigned 16 years. He did what was evil in the Lord's sight. He did not turn away from all the sins that Jeroboam, son of Nebat, had caused Israel to commit. That's the golden calves. But he walked in them. The rest of the events of Jehoash's reign, in other words, that which occurred between 798 and 782, the rest of the events of Jehoash's reign, along with all his accomplishments and the power he had to wage war against Judah's king Amaziah, are written in the historical record of Israel's kings, that same chronicle that's been lost. Jehoash 798-782, Jehoash rested with his fathers, and Jeroboam II, 782-753, sat on his throne. Jehoash was buried in Samaria with the kings of Israel. Now, not much is said about Kings in this book of Kings about Jehoash. However, we can look in 2 Chronicles and find out some more about Jehoash. What Jehoash is famous for, one of the things he's famous for, is his famous battle with King Amaziah of Judah. That war will be discussed in our next audio, chapter 14, when we look at King Amaziah of Judah's reign. It's also discussed in 2 Chronicles 25. I won't go into it in great detail here, but I'll just mention it in verses 17 through 18, 2 Chronicles 25. King Amaziah of Judah took counsel and sent word to Jehoash, son of Jehoaz, son of Jehu, king of Israel, saying, "Come, let us meet face to face." King Jehoash of Israel sent word to King Amaziah of Judah, saying, "The thistle that was in Lebanon sent a message to the cedar that was in Lebanon, saying, 'Give your daughter to my son as a wife.' Then a wild animal that was in Lebanon passed by and trampled the thistle." Now, my memory is fuzzy, but I know when you study hermeneutics, this little figure of speech that King Jehoash used here is famous, because I think it's the only example of a parable in the Old Testament, something like that. It's not really a parable, allegory. I forgot what it is, but it's famous. And the idea is, you got a big old cedar of Lebanon, and you got a little tiny thorn, and the thorn sent a message to the cedar. And of course, the thorn is Amaziah, who had sent a message to Jehoash and said, "Let's meet together. Let's face each other. Let's have a battle so I can win it," says Amaziah. And Jehoash is saying, "Hey, you are one cocky son of a gun. You're just like a little thorn talking to me, the big cedar, because I, King Jehoash, am a cedar." Well, then a wild animal that was in Lebanon passed by and trampled the thistle. That means you, Amaziah, are going down to defeat. Now, this actually happened. We'll see that in the next chapter, chapter 14. So Jehoash was famous for that little figure of speech and for beating Amaziah. He's also famous because he was with Elisha when Elisha died. So we'll turn to that now, 2 Kings 13, 14 through 18. When Elisha became sick with the illness that he died from, and we don't know where Elisha is now, it could be anywhere, he spent time in Carmel, he was at Bethel, he was at Samaria, he was at Jericho, he was a traveling prophet. So we don't know, he was a circuit rider. But wherever he was sick with the illness that he died from, and Jehoash, king of Israel, went down and wept over him and said, my father, the chariots and horsemen of Israel." Elisha responded, "Take a bow and arrows." So Jehoash got a bow and arrows. Then Elisha said to the king of Israel, Jehoash, "Put your hand on the bow." So the king Jehoash put his hand on it, and Elisha put his hand on the king's hands. Elisha said, "Open the east window." So Jehoash opened it. Elisha said, "Shoot." So Jehoash shot. Then Elisha said, "The Lord's arrow of victory." Yes, the arrow of victory over Aram. You are to strike down the Arameans and Aphek until you have put an end to them. Then Elisha said, "Take the arrows." So Jehoash took them. Then Elisha said to the king of Israel, to Jehoash, "Strike the ground." So Jehoash struck the ground three times and stopped. Now here's an inscrutable point of speculation. Why was Elijah translated whole, but Elisha had to die sick? You know, if I had my brothers, I'd rather be translated than dying sick. And there's no use trying to figure that one out, folks. That's like trying to figure out providence. Why did somebody end up like this, and why did somebody end up like that? You just got to take your life as you found it and as you find it, and then live one day at a time and see what God's going to do with you. And I don't think Elisha cared that he died that way. I mean, he's in heaven now, so he was old. He died after 65 years of prophesying, as Adam Clark says. And so Jehoash is crying. He's weeping when he sees Elisha. Now, that's ironic, because during Elisha's lifetime, Elisha's counsel was often neglected and despised. I don't know if Jehoash was one of the kings who had done that, but he's crying. But was he crying because of personal respect for Elisha? Or was he crying because he knew that Elisha had been of great service to the kingdom of Israel? His prayers had helped Israel out, and now the great man of God was leaving, and the kingdom might not have a prophetic voice to help it out. That's speculation. We don't know why he's crying. But he did say, Jehoash did, my father, Elisha, my father, the chariots and horsemen of Israel. Now, those are the same words that Elisha said to Elijah as Elijah went up to heaven. And Joash had probably heard about this. We read this in 2 Kings 2:12. As Elisha watched, he watched as Elijah was taken up in this fiery vision of chariots and horses. As Elisha watched, he kept crying out, my father, the chariots and horsemen of Israel. So that's the same words that Elisha used for Elijah leaving, and they're the same words that Jehoash is using as Elisha prepares to go to heaven. Well, what did Jehoash mean? Gill, Clark, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown all three agree that what Jehoash means is this, that Elisha is better to Israel with his prayers than chariots and horsemen of Israel would be of use to Israel. Adam Clark paraphrases it this way, what shall I do now that thou art dying? Thou art the only defense of Israel. In other words, Jehoash is saying to Elijah, you, my father, are the chariots and horsemen of Israel. You are the defense of Israel. And now that you're gone, we're not going to have anybody to defend Israel anymore. Well, Elisha is going to give some comfort to Jehoash. Oh, yes, you will. You can have somebody to defend Israel. So he responds and says, take a bow and arrows. Now, bow and arrows are not likely to be found in Elisha's house because Elisha was a prophet, not a military person. The bow and arrows were probably taken from the guards who attended Jehoash, who had come to visit Elisha in his house. Elisha tells him to open an east window, shoot the arrow toward the east. It was an ancient custom back then to shoot an arrow to cast a spear into a country which was about to be invaded. And so Jehoash would know exactly what this symbolism meant. Now in verse 16, Elisha tells Jehoash to put Jehoash's hand on the bow. He did so, and then Elisha put his hand on the king's hand. So we can picture this. Jehoash has got the bow. He's pulling the string. He's got one hand on the bow and one hand on the string that he's pulling, and Elisha has got one hand on top of the hand on the bow and one hand on top of Jehoash's hand on the string. What was he doing that for? Well, he's trying to show symbolically that God was going to bless Israel's arms in order to win the battle against Syria. The military guy was Jehoash. The spiritual guy was Elisha. God, Yahweh, speaking through Elisha, or working through Elisha, God is going to win the battle by guiding the hands of the Israelite king, Jehoash. Now, the arrow was shot through the east window. Actually, Syria lay more to the north, but I think that's a quibble to worry about that. Gill and Clark say that maybe the reference to the east may have referred to the lands east of the Jordan that Syria had captured, namely Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben. Maybe. Who knows? Now, at this time, the death of Elisha, it has been speculated by one of my commentators, this is during the times of Ben-Hadad III. Again, it could be either Hazael or Ben-Hadad III. Ben-Hadad III ruled from 807 to 780. Hazael was 801. He died in 801 and started reigning in 840. So somewhere in that period of those two kings, Jehoash operated. But this, some people have speculated that now we're under Ben-Hadad III, near the end of Jehoash's reign. Now in verse 17, Elisha says, Jehoash, you're to strike down the Arameans in Aphek. Where's Aphek? Well, it's a city in the land of Israel where the Syrians were routed in Ahab's time. We read about that in 1 Kings 20, where Ahab went out to fight the Syrians, beat them at the Battle of Aphek. 100,000 people were killed there. 27,000 were killed when the wall fell on them. You might recall that in 1 Kings 20. 1 Kings 20, verse 26 says this, in the spring, Ben-Hadad I, who ruled between 885 and 860, he mobilized the Arameans and went up to Aphek to battle Israel. Easton's dictionary says this, Aphek is a town on the road from Damascus to Palestine in the level plain east of the Jordan, near which Ben-Hadad was defeated by the Israelites. In other words, they don't know where it is. Easton says some people have identified it with the modern Fick, a place called Fick, 6 miles east of the Sea of Galilee. And some people, by the way, say that the battle didn't actually occur there because the text should be translated, you are to strike down the Arameans as it was done in Aphek, as in Aphek. In other words, as Ahab beat the Arameans in Aphek, you're going to strike the Arameans down. Not necessarily at Aphek, but you're going to get the same kind of victory. So verse 18, Elisha said, take the arrows. Jehoash took them. Elisha says to Jehoash, strike the ground. So Jehoash struck the ground three times, and then he stopped. Now, John Gill speculates that Jehoash did not have a good attitude when he was striking the ground with the arrows. Gill says that Jehoash thought the action was trifling and beneath him, and Jehoash struck the ground three times with the arrows only to please the prophet. He didn't do it with a good will. That's speculation. I don't know. But there is a question, though. In verse 19, our next verse, we will see that Elisha was angry with Jehoash for only striking three times. He says, you should have struck the ground five or six times. Well, why would Jehoash be blamed for this? He wasn't told by Elisha how many times to strike it. Elisha blames him after the fact for only striking three times and not five or six, but Elisha never told him to strike it five or six times. Well, what can we say about this? Well, some people have speculated he actually wasn't blamed by God for striking for three times. As Adam Clark says, just because Elisha was angry doesn't mean God was angry. Well, I don't know. The Holman Christian Study Translation said, Holman Christian Study Bible Translation says that Elisha was angry with him. I don't think that's a good option. I mean, I could look at the translations to see if we could come up with that, but I don't think that's so. I think that God was angry with Jehoash. Could be because he had a bad attitude, as I just finished saying. He struck the ground. Oh, come on, Elisha, don't make me do this. Bang, bang, bang. But he could have been blamed because Jehoash should have known the symbolism. He had already been explained about the symbolism of the arrow shot in the air. At least people speculate that. At any rate, it was the custom back then to shoot arrows toward lands that were going to be conquered, so he would understand that. But I still have trouble with that. Why would he expect it to strike the ground five times? Why not 50 times? Really get some victories over the Arameans. I find that a little bit strange. I guess the best answer is he just didn't have a good attitude about it. We weren't there, so we can't see. We go now to 2 Kings 13, verse 19. The man of God was angry with Jehoash and said, Elisha said, you should have struck the ground five or six times. Then you would have struck down Aram until you had put an end to them. But now you will only strike down Aram three times. Here's what Benson says about the man of God being angry. Quote, Jehoash's shooting was a symbolical action and intended to prefigure his victories over that nation. And therefore, Jehoash might easily understand that this second action of striking the ground with the arrow was to pretend the number of victories he was to obtain. So in other words, Benson is saying, Jehoash, you should have known better. And as Benson goes on to say, the quote-unquote generality of interpreters believe that Elisha probably had already told Jehoash what striking the ground would mean. We can speculate that Elisha tells Jehoash, hey, strike the ground. However many times you strike the ground, you're going to beat the Syrians. He only struck the ground three times, but shows that he didn't have faith in Yahweh, that Yahweh would allow him to beat the Syrians more than three times. So he only struck the ground three times. And that's why Elisha was angry with him, because he was saying, oh man, if you'd have just kept going, you could have really whipped up on the Syrians. But at any rate, these three times were fulfilled by Jehoash. In our chapter here, chapter 13, verse 25, we read this, then Jehoash, son of Jehoaz, took back from Ben-Hadad III, son of Hazael, the cities that Hazael had taken in war from Jehoash's father Jehoahaz. Jehoash defeated Ben-Hadad three times and recovered the cities of Israel. So, Elisha's dying prophecy was fulfilled. Good news for Jehoash. So we move now to 2 Kings 13, verses 20 and 21. Then Elisha died and was buried. Now Moabite raiders used to come into the land in the spring of the year. Once, as the Israelites were burying a man, suddenly they saw a raiding party. So they threw the man into Elisha's tomb. When he, that's the corpse, touched Elisha's bones, the man revived and stood up. So Elisha's power with God is still being manifested even after he died. Jameson Foster Brown says of Elisha, he, quote, enjoyed a happier life than Elijah, as he possessed a milder character and bore a less hard commission. His rough garment was honored even at the court. Well, I'm not exactly sure how you can say that Elisha had a happier life than Elijah. I guess you could say that Elijah ended up in exile, alone in a cave at Mount Sinai, chased, in danger of his life. So I guess so. The milder character, I don't know how Jameson Foster and Brown say that. I haven't really studied as a matter of contrast or a comparison in contrast between Elijah and Elisha. Might be an interesting study. At any rate, he's buried. Elisha is. Nobody knows where. Some say it's in Samaria. Could be Carmel. As I said, Elisha was a circuit rider, prophet, traveling all over the place. Now in the spring, when the harvest is ready, the fields are in, the crops are ready to be picked, that's when foreign invaders would come into the country to steal crops. So Moabite riders came in, and so some Israelites who were on a burial detail, they see the Moabites coming, they've got no choice, they apparently would dig in a tomb near Elisha's, digging a grave near Elisha's grave, and when they realized they didn't have time to finish the digging because they were being raided, they just tossed the man into Elisha's tomb and hauled Boogie out of there. And that was a blessing for the dead man. I guess it's a blessing. It's hard to say, because if he's in heaven and he comes back and he's got to live in the earth again, how is that a blessing? I don't know. Of course, he might have been in hell, so who knows? We don't know anything about this dead man. But he was resurrected when he touched Elisha's bones. Now, this is the first and last and only occasion for a resurrection caused by dead men's bones. The Roman Catholics have a lot of legends that say that, but no, this is the only scriptural occasion. It shows that Elisha didn't do miracles by his own power. Elisha's dead. His corpse did the miracle, which means that, of course, it was the power of God that did the miracle. Now, Benson speculates as to what were the purposes of this resurrection. Four purposes. Number one, to honor Elisha. Elisha raising somebody from the dead with his bones is not much inferior to Elijah's translation. So Elisha might have died sick, but he raised people from the dead. Option number two is for the purpose of the resurrection, to seal Elisha's prophecies in favor of Yahweh, to show that Elisha's prophecies were true and that Yahweh, therefore, is the true God. I mean, how many pagan gods, how could Baal or Astarte or Asherah, how could they raise somebody from the dead? They can't. But Yahweh's prophet Elisha did. So that means the golden calf idolatry, Baal and Astarte in the north, those idolatries were refuted by the very fact of this resurrection. Option number three is to why God did this resurrection. To strengthen Jehoash's faith as he fought the Syrians. He's got to beat them three times. If he ever runs into trouble, he can think, well, you know, the same prophet who prophesied that I'm going to beat the Syrians three times, that's the same prophet who raised somebody from the dead. Let's get going. Option number four, as far as the purposes of the resurrection, to comfort Elisha's followers with hopes of eternal life. You're not going to die if you follow Yahweh. Oh, good application point for present-day Christians. We go down to 2 Kings 13, verses 22 through 25, and we will finish this audio. Hazael, that's the Syrian king who ruled from 841 to 801. Hazael, king of Aram, oppressed Israel throughout the reign of Jehoash. He was from 814 to 798. That's the father of the Jehoash that we were just talking about, who was with Elisha when he died. But the Lord was gracious to them, gracious to the Israelites, had compassion on them, and turned toward them because of his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He was not willing to destroy them. They certainly deserved it, but he was not willing to destroy them because of the promise. Even now he has not banished them from his presence. King Hazael, the Syrian king, ruled from 841 to 801. King Hazael of Aram died, and his son Ben-Hadad III takes over and rules to 780, became king in his place. Then Jehoash, that's the Jehoash we were just talking about, the one that was with Elisha when he died, 798 to 782. Jehoash, son of Jehoaz, took back from Ben-Hadad III, son of Hazael, the cities that Hazael had taken in war from Jehoash's father, Jehoahaz. Remember, we said Jehoahaz was famous for getting his fanny whooped by the Syrians until he only had a rump army left. That's kind of what he's noted for. Well, Hazael was one of the kings that had done that, and Jehoash got the cities back from Hazael. Three times he beat them because he banged the arrow to the ground three times. Jehoash defeated Ben-Hadad three times and recovered the cities of Israel. Now notice that God is gracious to the Israelites. The word gracious is used right here in verse 23. But the Lord was gracious. He had grace. He gave them grace. This is despite the golden calf idolatry. Again, people that say that there's no grace in the Old Testament are ignorant. Ignoramuses, they're illiterate boobs. There's plenty of grace in the Old Testament, just like there's wrath in the New Testament. You know, people say, well, there's just a difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament. There's no wrath in the New Testament. Have you ever heard of the lake of fire? I mean, if that's not wrath, what is? Not to mention, Jesus said this temple in Jerusalem, not one stone was going to be left on top of another. But anyway, that's a little bit of a rabbit trail. We have a problem here in verse 23. The author of 2 Kings says that Yahweh was not willing to destroy the Israelites. Even now, Yahweh has not banished the Israelites from his presence. Well, the now, if it was referring to the time that the book of 2 Kings was being written, that would be, and if it was Jeremiah, that would be in before 586 when the Babylonians came in. And that presents a problem, because if you say that even now in around 600 BC, that God had not banished them from his presence, God had banished the Israelites from his presence in 722 BC when the Assyrians knocked over Samaria and took over the northern kingdom and exiled a bunch of the Israelites. They exiled the 10 lost tribes of Israel. That was 722. So how can verse 23 here in 2 Kings 13 say, even now God has not banished them from his presence? Well, you could say that Jeremiah didn't write 1 and 2 Kings and just get around the problem, because we don't really know who wrote it. But there's a problem with that, because we're going to see in 1 Kings, he's going to talk about kings all the way up until, I think, Zedekiah, if I remember correctly. And I do remember correctly, because I just looked it up. So that means that the book had to have been written somewhere around the Babylonian captivity in 586 BC. And so why does it say even now God has not banished them from his presence, when God had banished them from his presence in 722 BC? Well, we can say this, the even now does not refer to the time of the writing of 2 Kings, not to the time of the author, probably Jeremiah, but it refers to the time of Jehoash. As the pulpit commentary says, quote, there was still an interval of a century or a little more before the blow fell and the nation of the 10 tribes ceased to exist. That would be 722. We're now somewhere in, say, 798 when Jehoash took over. So you're talking about, well, 3/4 of a century later. So the even now is now in the time of Jehoash, God has not banished the Israelites from his presence. That makes sense to me. Another possibility is something I thought of, and I'm sure it's not right, but it could be that the people not banished were the Judahites, not the northern Israelites. And so when Jeremiah, supposedly Jeremiah, says, even now, at the time of the Babylonian captivity, he has not banished them from his presence, because 586 hasn't happened yet and the Babylonians haven't come yet. The problem with that is he's talking about northern kingdoms here, kings here, Jehoaz and Jehoash, his son. So I don't think that's an answer. It's just something I offer as a speculation. I think it's the even now is referring to the time of Jehoash, that God had not banished the Israelites from his presence, which they richly deserved. So we'll finish up the chapter with verse 25. Then Jehoash ruled from 798 to 782. Son of Jehoaz took back from Ben-Hadad, that's Ben-Hadad III. Son of Hazael, he ruled from 807 to 780. So Jehoash defeated Ben-Hadad III 3 times and recovered the cities of Israel, thus fulfilling the arrow prophecy when Jehoash banged the arrows 3 times in Elisha's dying sick room. Ladies and gentlemen, we have finished chapter 13 of 2 Kings. That prepares us to go to chapter 14 of 2 Kings. In our next audio, we'll do verses 1 through 28, and we will learn about the reign of Amaziah of Judah and Jeroboam II of Israel. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.